Crime lore contains descriptions of violent crime and frank discussions of cultural traditions that may be otherwise objectionable. Listener discretion is advised.
It's Christina from the future, or the present, however you want to consider things.
If you follow us on Twitter, you already know some of this, but I did just want to update everyone that the podcast has been on a little brief hiatus while I was dealing with some family things, and then to add to that, I developed COVID-19, so I am on my way to recovery. I understand from people that have been here that this might take a while, but I appreciate everybody's patience, and we are excited to share this episode with you. Josh's head was pounding. That was the first thing he became aware of. Then he realized his whole body was cold. Numb, almost. Slowly, he tried to piece together what had happened that night. Josh was proudly serving in the United States Navy. The ship he was on had just returned after 9 months of deployment. While his married shipmates were looking forward to spending time with their families, Josh and some of the other single sailors were thrilled to be somewhere where there were bars and clubs and some unfamiliar faces. Josh and his friends had ended up at a club not far from the base. The music was loud and the drinks were cheap and they were having a great time. Josh bought a drink for a cute, exotic-looking girl and asked her to dance. He couldn't hear her name over the music, but he wasn't too worried about it. He wasn't really looking to start something serious. He just wanted a fun night in the company of a pretty girl. The girl was a great dancer, and she seemed to be into him. After a couple of hours, and more drinks than he bothered to count, Josh looked around and realized that most of his friends had taken off. He wasn't worried. Even though his head was starting to feel fuzzy, he was pretty sure he could find his way back on his own. Right about then was when the woman he was dancing with slipped an arm around his neck and whispered in his ear, "It's getting kind of dead in here. I have a hotel room right down the street. Want to move the party there?" Josh thought of himself as a pretty upstanding guy, but when a hot chick invited him back to her hotel room, there was no chance of him saying no. He nodded yes and wandered to the bar to close out his tab. For a second, while he was standing there waiting for the bartender, the room started spinning, and he had to grab onto the bar to keep from falling. He covered quickly, though. No way he wanted this woman thinking he couldn't hold his liquor. After he paid, the woman grabbed him by the hand and led him out of the club. As promised, the hotel where she was staying was just a few buildings down. It was kind of a run-down place, but Josh didn't care that much. He wasn't picky. He was becoming increasingly concerned he was going to puke on the carpet, though. The alcohol had affected him more than he expected. When the woman pressed another drink into his hand, he almost turned it down. And that was the last thing he remembered. His head still pounding, Josh forced his eyes open and realized immediately why he was so cold. He was lying in a bathtub full of ice. The ice was tinged red close to his body. Taped to his left hand was a cheap cell phone. More chilling than the ice, though, was the note written on the shower wall in front of him. "Call 911," it read. "Your kidneys have been removed." Josh barely managed to dial 911 before passing out again. Later, at the hospital, doctors confirmed that both of Josh's kidneys had been removed. Police later informed him that he had fallen prey to an increasingly common crime. Guys, often young service members or college students, would meet an attractive woman at a club. The woman would drug the man and lure him back to a hotel room where accomplices would remove their kidneys or liver. Police believed the organs were being sold on the black market to wealthy customers who needed organs and didn't want to wait on transplant lists.
Hello, and welcome back to Crime Lore, the podcast that investigates the intersections of folklore and true crime. I am your host, Christina Downs, here as always with my friend and colleague, Jesse Fivecoat.
Hello.
And just before we really launch into this week's legend and topic, I want to just get a little business out of the way with. This is our, believe it or not, this is the first episode that we are recording since we launched. So we wanted to get a good number of episodes kind of in the can before we launched so that we knew we had something to work with, gave ourselves a little bit of a buffer. And I think that was a really good idea for a couple of reasons, mostly that October and November were crazy for us.
They really were.
October's always a busy month for folklorists. It is the only month of the year when we're really cool and everyone wants to talk to us. But
that's true.
It is also when we have our big annual meeting, so that, and then we had other complications in the holidays and this and that. So the downside of that is that there were things that we didn't know to fix until I would have helped if I'd edited them as we recorded them, but I didn't. And so there were some audio issues we know, especially with Jesse being a little quieter than me.
Which is normally not the issue.
So that is not normally a thing people would worry about. But we're hopefully we have fixed that. And if not, we're still working to fix it. Just know that we are aware of the issue. The other thing is, now that we have some listeners, I want to say hello and send some special shout-outs to our international listeners. So to our listeners in Russia, I want to say Zdravstvuyte. To our listeners in France, which is where we have our highest international listenership.
Nice.
I would like to say bonjour. I don't speak French, so please excuse that pronunciation. And to our listeners in Brazil, bem-vinda. To our listeners in Germany, Guten Tag, and to our listeners in Australia and New Zealand, hello and welcome.
Hello, everyone.
I will not torture you all with my Australian accent, because I'm actually pretty good with a lot of accents. Australian is not one I can do.
I don't think, I mean, I'm not good at any accent, but I don't think I could do it either.
I don't know why that's a difficult one. And then also, of course, to all of our U.S. listeners, hello and welcome. Especially, well, I don't know if it's especially, or a lot of you are family members of mine, and I appreciate you all listening. But I really appreciate those of you who are not related to me and are still listening to this podcast. So, this week, oh, the other thing is that we only realized retroactively that we did 3 episodes in a row that dealt heavily with dead children, so if that got a little dark, I mean, it's a crime podcast.
Right, and it's about legends, too. Legends.
Right. Legends are dark.
They are dark. There's no way around it.
Yeah. There's not a lot of legends that are, everything was happy, and then some happy stuff happened, and things were wonderful.
No.
So anyway, we didn't do that on purpose. It's not that we have any kind of pent-up animosity towards children, and this week's does not deal explicitly that much with dead children, but it does deal with death, as we talk about organ theft narratives. Although, in a lot of the legends, we have a live victim.
Right.
Who's alive at the end. This narrative of, this young man going out and beating an attractive woman and then waking up in a bathtub full of ice with his kidneys missing and a cell phone in his hand.
See, you had mentioned the cell phone earlier. I never heard the variant with the cell phone.
Oh, interesting.
The one I always heard, it was written in lipstick on the mirror that says, call 911.
Okay, so I always heard, I think, a note that said, I don't remember if it explicitly said how the note was transmitted, so it could have been on the mirror or in his hand, but that the call 911 was in reference to the phone that was in his hand.
I got it, okay.
But interesting, these details that come in and out.
Right, and I would have thought by the time I heard it in, like, middle school, well, cell phones weren't that popular, though.
It's actually, now that I'm thinking about this, I swear I heard this in high school, which would have been the mid to late 90s, and cell phones were not that, so maybe I added that detail in my head later on.
Huh. I'm sure, I mean, with all of these things, at some point there has to be a variant where the person wakes up with a cell phone.
Yeah. But there's definitely some, in this particular version of organ theft narratives, which is sometimes called the kidney heist, there's some clear connections to another legend, the AIDS Mary legend, which we might talk about at some other point, but it's a similar situation, except instead of waking up missing his kidneys, our gentleman wakes up to a note on the mirror saying, welcome to the wonderful world of AIDS, and the implication being that this woman is going around deliberately infecting men with HIV AIDS. And they seem to have kind of started circulating around the same time.
Yeah.
So it makes sense. You have similar legends addressing overlapping topics. I don't know if we call it.
Yeah.
They're both dealing with medical issues.
They are. I'm trying to, like, I'm thinking, that silence is me thinking of, like, what is the relationship? Are they, because other than, you know, like you said, waking up and finding out that this terrible thing had happened to you, once you slept with a stranger, had the intention to go back to their room and sleep with a stranger, one, you get infected, the other one, something is taken away from you. I guess in both, something is taken away from you, but...
Right. Well, and one thing that I hadn't thought about until I started doing notes for this episode, the AIDS Mary legend has male and female variants.
Yeah.
So there's differences in the way it's told about men and differences right. in the way it's told about women. I don't know of any female variants of the organ theft narrative. I don't know of any stories where it's a woman who wakes up missing her kidneys.
That's a good point. I don't think I know of any variant of women either.
And the thing I was thinking about, you know, by way of explanations of this, losing your kidneys are not what women are worried about when they meet strange men out at bars. It's Fair. A lot of things that women are worried about when we meet straight men. That was a Freudian slip there. When we meet strange men out at bars, it's not losing our kidneys.
Yeah.
It's, you know, sexual assault, murder, those sorts of things are more so what we're worried about. And so maybe that's why there isn't a female variant of this, because we don't need that added thing to make us be wary of men. We have lots of... We can just read the news every day to make us be afraid of men.
That's a really interesting point in that, right, so as you said, we have these variants where it's always men, and I guess this fits in with what you're saying now, is they always live. Like, the presumption is that you will live, even if you're missing both of your kidneys. Like, you men interacting with strange women will always live. But we don't have that reverse narrative.
No. It's also, and I'm just thinking of this now, but it's also very heteronormative. I don't know of any where he meets a charming young man and goes back to his. Which in some ways is almost surprising, because...
Yeah, because again, it's circulating at the same time as Welcome to the World of AIDS.
Right.
Like, you would think that there would be a variant of that, and also, like, infection with HIV.
Right. And maybe that ties back to gay men have lots of other things to act as kind of social, I don't know what I'm trying to say, but things to control their behavior socially.
Right. And also, during this time when these were circulating, gay men were never seen as the victim.
Right.
They were the perpetrators. They were the ones who were intentionally infecting. And so if you did have a gay man as a victim, then you would have to see them as a victim.
Right.
Something I don't think people were wanting to do or willing to do then.
As we've said before, legends are not necessarily the most enlightened genre.
No.
They aren't very progressive in their social views. So this variant started circulating mostly in the U.S. and other industrialized nations in the 90s. And initially, most variants were taking place in an exotic locale. So it was a guy from one of those countries who went to somewhere exotic, somewhere, you know, South America, the Caribbean, Asia, and meets this beautiful woman, and this terrible thing happens to him. Gradually, that shifted over to being kind of cities that were marked as dangerous, but still in industrialized countries. So New York, Las Vegas, Detroit. Apparently, the European target was usually Paris, which...
Really?
To an American mind, Paris is not a city I think of
being
dangerous, but perhaps to other countries in Western Europe, it is the country that's like, oh, that's the place where dangerous things can happen. I don't know.
I was going to say, when I heard it, it was always about the U.S. And I think I'm trying to remember if... I always thought it was like a beach place, but I think maybe I'm conflating the Welcome to the World of AIDS and... the organ theft together, because that often happens at, like, spring break locations.
Right. Yeah, there is so much overlap that it's a little hard to kind of piece out in my mind what I heard when.
Right.
I do remember, as I said, I remember hearing this in high school, and when I heard it, and I can't remember for sure who I heard it from, but what I heard was that this was something that the Air Force was sending out to young servicemen as a way of telling them, be careful, this thing is happening.
So it's like a news thing.
Right.
They were telling them, this stuff has happened, be wary.
Yeah. And framing it as this happened to either an officer or an enlisted man in the Air Force. And I'm from a military family, I come from a military area, so I don't know if this was someone in my family that told me that this was going on, if this was someone that I went to school with. It could have either way. And by the way, in folklore, that's what we call a validating formula, saying that the Air Force is saying this is real, so it must be real. But because of that, I think I assumed that it happened to a guy who was TDY or on temporary duty assignment somewhere overseas. But I don't know that that was actually part of the narrative. I think I just filled that in based on the assumption that this was happening to someone who was in the Air Force.
Right. Or or it could have been the variant that you heard, again, growing or being around a heavily military area.
But also, having grown up in a heavily military area, I can tell you that military guys know how to party when they're stateside also. So it's with much love to our servicemen and women. But so interestingly, the variants that circulated outside of the industrialized world usually were, it was the Americans or the Western Europeans who were the villains, who were kidnapping usually street children or poor children, were being like disappearing off the street and later being found either missing their kidneys or missing their eyes sometimes.
So it does involve children again then.
Right. But surviving children.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair.
And in most of these cases, they were found with a note and cash in their pocket. And the note saying something like, thanks for the kidneys or thanks for the eyes.
The eyes?
Yeah, as their eyes were being stolen.
I don't remember eye variants.
I don't remember that either.
That's... I don't like eye things, so that is...
No. A person who was just told she needs to take drops for dry eye and cannot get eye drops into my eyes, narratives of eyes being stolen is... So, to look at some realities related to organ trafficking in and of itself is a very real problem in the world. The American Transplant Foundation says that in the United States there are currently over 123,000 people on transplant lists. And in 2015, only 30,970 organ transplants took place. So
yikes.
You look at those numbers, you can see where there's a disparity of more people needing organs than organs that are available. The U.S. does import organs. A lot of countries do not. That seems shady to me. I don't know that much about the reality.
I was going to say, where do you import, like... Do they have just specific countries that they
Well, so we'll talk about some of the instances, and I would hope that there are some guidelines and at least some medical practitioners that are ethical about it and go, oh, do we really want that kidney from China? There were, from 1987 to 2006, almost 17,000 families that filed lawsuits saying that loved ones' body parts were illegally sold. And this is a lot of cases of, you know, their loved one had some kind of accident and was on life support, and then all of a sudden they found out that their kidneys had been donated and they hadn't actually signed a consent saying that that was possible.
Honestly, this reminds me of when in high school and first getting my driver's license, all my friends told me not to sign up to be a donor because if you are in an accident or something, they'll just let you die so that they can... use your organs.
Yeah, I definitely heard the same thing as in high school. And my mother is a nurse, so she was very pro organ donation. It was very like, yes, you should definitely sign. And I did. And while I fully think that's a personal choice, that is the choice I would advocate to other people too.
Yeah.
I can remember my 10th grade lab partner saying that he wasn't going to sign his because he basically he implied he was worried they were going to steal his genitalia. And I was like, Thomas, nobody wants your genitalia. I don't know that they were doing penis transplants in the 90s.
That's just so bizarre.
I don't
so
even
bizarre.
Know for sure that they're doing them now, but I imagine they probably are, because...
Yeah, why not?
Men in their parts, but...
Yeah.
That was such a bizarre reason to say I'm not going to be an organ donor because I want to make sure I have my junk with me when I am buried.
Well, that's the thing. Yeah, it's like you would not need it.
Right. But yes, that is that, you know, that distrust, that idea that if they know that you're going to donate your organs, they have less incentive to save your life. The reality of that, of course, is if you really are in an accident and you're in an emergency room and they're rushing to treat you, they're probably not digging your driver's license out of your pocket and going, oh, look, this one's an organ donor, let's just quit. I mean, even if that was where medical practitioners tended to fall ethically, which I don't think it is, but even if it was, the reality is they're not going to know in most cases.
Right. Now, yeah, that makes sense.
I do know, you know, this is a debate when people are legitimately in comas, that there are a lot of cases where people say, I feel like they were trying to encourage me to take my loved one off life support because they wanted their organs. And that, you know, that gets into a really gray area. I believe that that's what these people felt like was happening.
Yeah.
I think probably if you talk to the doctors, they would have a different side of it.
Right. And is it a chicken or an egg type of thing? Like, did they hear these stories beforehand and that they're reading the situation as though that is what's happening?
Right. And this does, you know, and we'll talk about it more as the episode goes on, but I think a lot of these narratives relate to a deep-seated mistrust of medical practitioners and the medical establishment, which is not totally unearned.
Right.
So anyway, paid harvesting for organs happens in many parts of the world. It is illegal in the United States. However, voluntary donation of organs is common in the U.S. and Scandinavia, and this is voluntary donation of organs you don't have to have in order to live. So one of your kidneys, part of your liver.
Got it.
Those sorts of donations. And while I totally understand why it's legal to voluntarily, as an altruistic act, say, I'll give you your kidney, but it's not legal to say, I will give you my kidney for $30,000, it seems a little strange to say, it's okay to give this away for free, but...
Especially in such a, like, capitalistic society, like, I feel like there would be a thing of, like, yeah, you can sell it, but make sure you're getting a good price for it.
Right. And I'm curious to know if there's any regulation about what constitutes payment for an organ. So, obviously, me giving you $30,000 cash for your kidney, it's clearly me paying you for your kidney. But if I said, if you give me your kidney, I'll send your kid to college.
Right. Or you can have this house.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know.
And how would you even regulate that? Because you could I could just say, no, it was not an agreed upon thing. I'm just so grateful that Jesse gave me the gift of life that I want to make sure that his kids have a great education.
Also, like, are there people, and maybe there are, like, checking that, you know?
So, the selling of organs does absolutely still happen in the U.S., despite it being illegal. And there was a sting. So people will literally advertise their organs on Craigslist.
You really can get anything on Craigslist.
Type AB negative and got a healthy kidney, not a smoker, a drug user. Give me a call. And after finding this out, I think it was the FBI, I'm not positive, but some branch of law enforcement did a sting operation, basically, where they posted fake ads to see who would contact them. And not only were they contacted by prospective recipients who were like, yes, I would love that kidney. They were also contacted by organ traffickers who were like, hey, I'll help you sell your kidney and get a better price for it. And by doctors who said, if you find someone who wants this kidney, I will happily perform the transplant for XYZ fee.
Oh, no.
So, clearly this is going on.
So I know nothing of the dark web, but isn't this something that, like, maybe not on Craigslist. I mean, it probably is happening on the dark web, too, but...
Right. Yeah, I'm sure it is. And, of course, money can buy you everything. Not everything, but money can buy you a lot.
Yeah.
And so, the issue is, I wouldn't begin to know how to get on the dark web to go look for something on the dark web. And I think probably most people in need of kidneys or lungs or half a liver are in the same space.
That's a fair point.
that doesn't mean that they couldn't hire someone to go right. find this on the dark web for them.
So Craigslist just conveniently compiles all of this, all of your needs in one place.
Right.
That should be their new slogan.
Yeah. So according to the UN, there are three main forms of organ trafficking, none of which are killing someone for an organ, which is a thing that happens, but there's tricking donors into donating for free, so framing it in some kind of way that they think if they're going to get some kind of benefit from it, or they think they're helping some really deserving person when really it's just some old rich guy, that sort of thing. Then there's offering someone money and not paying. So saying, you know, yeah, I'll absolutely give you $30,000 for your kidney and then just disappearing after we've got your kidney.
Yeah.
And probably dumping you off somewhere where you're not going to get adequate follow-up care. And then there are also doctors who remove organs claiming that they have to for medical reasons, but really because they have someone else who wants them more.
That's terrifying. So, like, that really is.
Oh, you have had a horrible infection and your kidney got so damaged I have to remove it before it spreads to the rest of your body, and really the kidney was fine all along.
Right, and you're terrified and you think that this needs to happen and you trust them and you don't really have time for a second opinion.
Right, yeah. So the first conviction for proven organ trafficking in the U.S., which again, not the first time it happened, just the first time they had clear right. evidence of it and convicted somebody, it was 2012, and it was a doctor based in New York named Levi Rosenbaum, who was recruiting poor donors in Israel to donate kidneys, and he was generally paying them $10,000 for their kidney and then selling it for $120,000.
Oh, so, my God.
Major markup.
Also, 2012? That is so much later than I would have thought.
Right. And I think this is just about it being difficult to trace, especially when this is happening internationally. This is happening to the people that are being victimized by this are people who don't often have access to a means to get their story out. They don't have right. an easy way to contact a reporter. They don't have an easy way to build a web page or post all over social media. And even if they do, who's going to believe them?
That, this is, the reality of this is so much more terrifying. Because again, I'm a legend scholar. Like, I hear the legends, I understand what they're doing socially, and I'm not as disturbed by them, because I see them as a way of expressing collective fears and anxieties.
Right.
But attaching this to these cases, I get why the fear and anxiety is there, and now it makes me fearful and anxious.
Right? And while there has never been a verified situation like we have in the legend of someone waking up missing their kidneys, right. there are definite cases of mysterious deaths where organs then disappeared that have raised questions about whether people were being killed for their organs. One case, so one just kind of general one, in Juarez in Mexico, on the U.S.-Mexico border, where there's a really high rate of femicide, there have been some victims found without internal organs, raising questions about why these women were killed. But in 2013, a model and aspiring actor named Ryan Singleton was driving from Las Vegas to Los Angeles when his car broke down in Death Valley. The highway patrol picked him up, drove him to a gas station in Baker, California, where he called a friend, and then when the friend arrived, he was gone. He just disappeared. His body was found 2.5 months later, so decomposed that the cause of death could not be determined, and most of his internal organs were missing. Now, investigators have said, and it's not totally out of left field to say, his body was hardly decomposed and it was in the middle of the desert. Scavengers right. probably took the organs.
Yeah.
And people have looked at the autopsy, said, you know, there's no evidence of clean cuts. It's, you know, there's really no way to tell because the body yeah. was so decomposed by the time it was found. It certainly raises questions.
But do his loved ones, his friends and family, like, have they expressed that they think that this is
yes.
organ theft?
Yes. And his mother also seems to believe that maybe he was apparently, shortly before his disappearance, he said something to her along the lines of, something bad's going to happen to me, isn't it? And she said, why do you think that? Do you owe someone money? And he wouldn't tell her. And then this happened. So she definitely thinks he was a victim of foul play, and she right. does believe that his organs were stolen. Another instance, also in California. What's going on, California? In 2015, an inmate at the California State Prison Solano named Nicholas Anthony Rodriguez was found dead with most of his chest organs and all of his abdominal organs removed. They said the body was virtually cut in half. This happened in a medium security prison, which presumably has a lot of surveillance, and no one has any idea how it happened or how his body got into a trash can in a shower where it was basically folded in half.
That is so shifty. Like,
yeah. This did happen shortly after a riot at the prison, though all the news accounts describe it as a riot, and then from reading it sounds like maybe it was just a big fight that then led to everybody being confined to their cells. Like, you hear prison riot and you think, like, a big multi-day stand. Yeah. These things that we see on TV.
Yeah.
That doesn't sound like that's what it was. And he was not found for 15 hours after the so-called riot, even though everyone was supposed to have been in their cells long before that.
Yeah, maybe it's just the fact that I have, you know, preparing for this conspiracy theory course, like, my mind is very much on conspiracy theory, but this has a lot of the trappings of something else is going on.
And so there are allegations that the riot was a cover-up, well, like a diversion to cause this murder to happen. There's a lot of questions. How did anyone have, even if the prison administration is basically saying he was killed by another prisoner, we think it was his cellmate, and we've isolated him, so there's no more danger to the rest of the population. you know, that seems like and I don't know, his cellmate doesn't sound like he's a good, upstanding guy, so...
Well, it's his cellmate, like...
Right. It's believable.
Yeah.
But it also seems convenient, and no one can explain where his organs went to.
Yeah. Oh, wait, yeah,
they're just... If supposedly it was a fellow inmate who killed him, what did he do with all of his organs? And...
Nah.
Even if we're going to go ahead and go, he ate them because he's secretly a cannibal, even though that does not seem to have been anything associated with him before. That's a lot to eat in 15 hours. And not to be graphic, but...
None of that.
And if you were just trying to kill someone...
Why take the organs?
Why take the organs and then hide them so that they couldn't be found?
Yeah, I'm not buying it.
And one thing that's important to keep in mind here, both Singleton and Rodriguez were men of color. Singleton was also gay. These are populations that have not historically been treated well by the medical establishment in this country. We have lots of known examples of, you know, black men being victims of medical experiments that they were not told about.
Yeah.
All sorts of things. So you can understand why their family would be less likely to trust the official narrative when the official narrative is, nope, it was just, you know, he just happened to wander out in the desert and die of exposure and animals ate his organs. Well, that's very possible. That I have no problem believing that could happen. But I can also understand why if I'm his family, I'm not willing to accept that explanation without any...
And
further investigation.
And the fact that he was at a gas station waiting for someone who he knew was on their way to pick him up. Like, why would he leave that spot?
Right.
That also doesn't make sense. I have a quick question because this reminds me.
Sure.
And maybe you're going to get to it, but I'm thinking with the Rodriguez case. That was the first case, right?
That was the Singleton. The prison one was the Rodriguez case.
So the Singleton one. when you said that the autopsy, there is no clean cut, I'm thinking of legends about animals, mostly cows and horses that have had, like, surgical cuttings on them and organs removed from them. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, like the cattle mutilations.
Yeah.
But
I've seen other ones where, like... So, some of the cattle mutilation, they're, like, completely drained of blood.
Right.
Other ones, like, organs are missing. And I never, like, really put it into,
yeah, I hadn't, like, connected that either, but that's...
But it seems like, I don't know, maybe... I'm just connecting it now, but I'm thinking maybe that is connected.
No, and I know, you know, I've heard things about... Well, sometimes it looks like a clean cut because it was just where the skin split because as it dried out and that's gonna... And I've, with cows, not yeah. with humans, but presumably, I mean, humans at the end of the day are also just animals.
Yeah.
I know there are, the stereotype about if you have a cat and you die, your cat's going to eat your corpse, whereas your dog is going to sit there for days right. guarding your dead body.
Yeah.
And that's apparently not true at all. They will both eat you. There's just a difference in how they're going to eat you. And that's so that. Cats are very efficient predators. They're going to go right for your internal organs because they know that they have the most nutrients. So people who get eaten by their cats are found eviscerated, whereas people who get eaten by their dogs are just, like, have their extremities chewed on.
Okay.
So. Yeah.
That's why I will always have dogs.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really care after I'm dead.
That's fair.
The only reason I don't want my pet to eat my body is that I think they would then put it down, and I don't want them to do that.
Yeah.
But I don't care if my cat eats me after I die.
But then no one wants to, like, rehome the killer cat.
Right. I've always heard, I assume it also applies to cats, but I've always heard that any dog that eats human flesh is going to get a taste for it and therefore has to be put down.
Yeah.
I feel like that's also legend.
Yeah.
Do we really taste that good?
What makes it any different than them eating chicken, you know, or pork? Like,
yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, then they like it after, but they're not going out there attacking, like, livestock.
Yeah.
Most of the time.
Right. and we're getting a little bit off topic here. But in terms of animal predation, like, I imagine that there's probably differences in wild animals as to how they're going to attack a body that's lying there.
But I'm thinking, like, and now I just want to know, and I don't think that we're going to cover that here because we just don't know, but are there legends where people are taking, say, a horse
organs? Animal organs and implanting them in humans?
Yes,
oh,
yeah.
I don't know.
I mean, that is a thing, right? Like, you can put, like, pig's heart or something?
I've heard, like, baboon's hearts in humans,
yeah.
But I don't know.
Again, we traffic in legends, but we also live in the world, so
I'm a doctor. I'm not that kind of doctor.
Right.
So not fully aware, but I wonder, and you know, it's legend, so it could always be some kind of experimental procedure that people have come up with, and that's why it's having to be done illegally, and we're gonna just start the legend here now.
That is something that I want to check out afterwards. Maybe we can give an update on, or if any of you know,
heard things connecting certain types of cattle or livestock mutilations to organ trafficking, that would be fascinating.
Let us know.
Yes. Crimelore@gmail.com. So, the other thing, just talking about organ trafficking, is forced organ harvesting, which is basically taking someone's organs without their will. This seems to be happening most currently in China, generally with political prisoners. Up until 2015, it was perfectly legal in China to harvest organs from executed prisoners. China claims that they don't do that anymore. A lot of international bodies think that that's false. Most of these executed prisoners are political prisoners.
Right.
So a lot of, historically, this has mostly been practitioners of Falun Gong, which is a religious sect. There are a lot of allegations right now that this is also happening to Uyghur prisoners.
Right.
But again, the Chinese government denies it. They claim that they've stopped doing any of this since 2015. What is clear is that there's an unusual amount of organ transplants happening in China still.
Got it.
And
like, more so than just the sheer numbers of the population?
Right. Like, enough that people are coming from all over the world to get organ transplants in China.
Oh, okay.
Which is the other thing I really want to emphasize here, because I think it's very easy for us in the U.S. and other Western countries to kind of go, oh yeah, that happens in China, because China's a terrible place.
Right.
Well, it may be happening in China, but a lot of people from other countries are participating in that.
Yeah.
And there was a doctor from Israel, and I'm probably going to mispronounce his name, I think Jacob Lavie, maybe L-A-V-E-E, who is the director of the heart transplantation unit at Sheba Medical Center in Israel, and chair of the Heart and Lung Transplantation Committee at the Israeli National Transplant Center. And he started investigating this in 2005 after a patient of his who had been on a list waiting for a heart transplant was notified by his insurance company that he should go to China because he was scheduled to receive a transplant there in 2 weeks. Now, you can't schedule a heart transplant 2 weeks in advance because you would have to know that the person was going to die 2 weeks from now.
Oh, yeah.
And so that immediately raised alarm bells. And he said that this doctor said he knew a lot of Israelis were going to China and getting kidney transplants, and he assumed that this was probably poor people who were being paid for their kidneys, and he said this isn't ethical, it's not legal in most countries, but that wasn't something that he was willing to make a big intervention about. But then when it was a heart, it's like, okay, well, this isn't coming from a living donor.
Right.
And so he started looking into this, and... But the other disturbing part there is that this person's insurance company had arranged it. So this is an insurance company based out of Israel that is arranging a transplant under very shady circumstances.
Right, because it's probably cheaper, I would guess.
I'm sure. And so in 2008, Israel passed a law banning insurance companies from reimbursing organ transplants overseas. I don't know what laws are in other countries in terms of insurance companies, and I would assume that U.S. insurance companies aren't going to reimburse you for a transplant from overseas just because U.S. insurance companies do everything possible to avoid reimbursing you.
Yeah.
So it seems like that would be a nice out for them.
Yeah.
Not because they're such ethical organizations, but just because...
They don't want to pay.
Right. By the way, in 2006, China conducted 11,000 transplants from executed prisoners. Now, this doesn't mean 11,000 donors, because, of course, right. there's multiple organs, but...
But also, that's a lot of executed prisoners.
Right.
And I'm guessing, I would venture to guess they didn't harvest from all of them. Just that right. I'm guessing that there would be some where you couldn't.
Right. Although some of the implication is that when you have a really wealthy person who is looking for an organ, basically that there's a database where they have everybody's blood types and they can go, oh, this prisoner right now has the same blood type as this billionaire from Egypt who really needs a heart. Why don't we see if they're compatible donors, and then we'll move up his execution date. So the idea is basically that they're determining who they're executing based on whose organs they can use.
This sounds like some dystopian novel type thing.
It is absolutely some dystopian novel type stuff, yeah. There is also something that the UN refers to as transplant tourism, which is basically when you go to another country to get an organ.
For fun? Like, I don't know why they're calling it tourism.
I think just because of the travel aspect and the, like, capitalism aspect of it.
Huh.
Again, these are mostly, I'm sure there's a medical term for it, but those organs that you can donate and still be a living donor. So kidneys.
Yeah.
Lobes of livers, that kind of thing.
Got it.
And it's generally, that seems to be the situation where poor people are being exploited by being convinced to sell parts of their bodies. This other thing that I didn't know was a... I should have known that this was a thing. I had just never thought about it. I didn't know that there's also a big market in the sale of cadaver organs. So these are not things that could be used for transplants because they're not viable anymore.
Okay.
But these are used for education purposes, for research... Basically, they don't get enough bodies donated to science to do the amount of research and education stuff that they want to on them.
So and who's selling them?
So this is much less regulated. So it's not illegal. You're
like,
supposed to, of course, have the consent of the person's next of kin in order to do that. But because it's not illegal, it's a lot harder to regulate.
So I'm just thinking, like, one... Would the next of kin be willing to do that? Because I would guess that they would want to honor the wishes, and had the person wanted to be donated in the first place or have their organs donated, they would. Two, who's getting the money?
Right. That's where it gets really shady, and it's usually not the families.
So are these, like, medical examiners, or...
Yeah, so it seems to be a lot of funeral morticians. Homes. There was a big... And this is how I first learned about it. The podcast Criminal did an episode on this case in Colorado. It was the Sunset Mesa Funeral Home. And what seems to have been happening is when families wanted to cremate bodies, like, oh yeah, we'll cremate your loved one, and then sell what they could, and then give them something that resembled ashes.
Whoa.
Which at least in one case was found to be concrete dust. So they didn't even, they were given an urn, which they were told had their loved one's ashes in it, and it was not at all.
That is, honestly, I shouldn't be shocked at all. Like, but it is, I don't know, it didn't, yeah, I think the same thing with the organ theft. I, like, heard these stories, but I always just thought, you know, these are legends, but hearing the true crime right. aspect of it is just gross.
It's just not a thing you would think you have to worry about.
Yeah.
And this all gets around to, I think, at one of the major cores of the legend is distrust of medical establishment, which there seems to be legitimate reason
right.
to, and again, especially right now, I know that our medical workers are working under horrible conditions and doing really great work.
Yeah.
So I have nothing but love for our doctors and nurses and everyone else working in. But the fact that the medical establishment in the United States is so profit-driven and so money-driven, I think creates reasons that people don't trust it because
yeah.
they feel like they are nothing more than a source of money.
Yeah.
And if you can't be a living source of money, maybe they can sell parts of you and make money off of them somehow or another.
Oy.
And I want to be clear that I don't think this is happening at wide scale in the
yeah,
US.
Yeah, yeah.
Or probably anywhere. You know, something's happening in China that a lot of people are concerned about
yeah.
as to how many doctors are complicit in it and how voluntarily complicit in it they are. It's hard to say. And China is not the only place where that kind of thing is happening, by the way. But that's one of the things with the legends that I always found least believable is the legend. So this legend, this guy wakes up and his kidneys have been removed and he's been closed up and someone's
yeah.
cared enough for him to pack him in ice and tell him to call 911. This definitely implicates medical practitioners. So it can't just be common criminals that are saying, oh, let's get this guy drunk and steal his kidneys.
Right.
They have to have doctors working for them.
Right. They had the medical precision and knowledge to take it, one, without killing them.
Right.
And then to, yeah, stitch him up.
And the part that was always hardest for me to believe is that they would bother leaving him alive after this.
Yeah.
Because if you are so unethical that you're willing to steal two kidneys from one person, are you also ethical enough that you're going to not just go through the effort of saving this person's life, but leave behind a living witness who
yeah.
might be able to give some kind of evidence that's going to get you convicted.
Yeah. I don't know. People are complex.
Right. People do have really strange ways that they draw lines. And so Veronique Campion-Vincent, I don't know if I'm saying her name correctly, she's a French legend scholar. She identifies as a sociologist, evidently, but we won't hold that against her.
She's a folklorist.
Right. I think she's published a lot in folklore journals. But she makes two big arguments. She's done a lot of study of these organ theft narratives and different variants. She says, basically, these legends reflect anxiety over the power that medical experts have to traffic in life and death. And also that they are a critique of global economic disparity and exploitation of the developing world. And I think, you know, it's pretty easy to see, especially in this incarnation, I think the first one is more evident.
Yeah.
But she brings up some interesting facets of organ donation that I hadn't thought about. And it gets into how we define life and death.
Mm-hmm.
So in American culture, we still very much define a person's status as alive or dead based on whether their heart's beating. Even though, scientifically speaking, we know that brain death is
right.
really what is more significant.
So you're saying, like, the legal recognition is heart beating in the U.S. and that means alive? Or
well,
or just a popular,
I think the popular
understanding
more so. Although there are, you know, something that comes up a lot in abortion debates, that a fetus is considered alive if its heart is beating, even if it has something else wrong with it that makes it completely incompatible with life.
Yeah.
It's still considered a termination if the heart is beating.
Yeah.
You know. So that's something that comes up. But you can take organs from a patient that still has a beating heart if their brain is dead. If they have no higher brain function, then they're considered available for organ transplant. And this is a thing, I think, where folk understandings of life and death and medical things and medical understandings have very, there's a big gap there.
Yeah.
And I also say, like, from my standpoint, again, I'm a doctor, I'm not that kind of doctor, but it seems to me that science really doesn't understand the human brain very well. And they admit that.
Right.
But then there are moments where they say, okay, the brain, this patient's brain has suffered an injury from which it cannot return.
Right.
And therefore, the course of action is to donate their organs if the family is willing and to take them off life support. And most of the time, I think that they're correct. And this is why, by the way, I think that everyone should have a living will. I don't, but I know my parents do, but everyone should leave instructions for this kind of thing so that your loved ones don't have to make these kind of decisions.
Yeah.
Because as much as I think that they're correct most of the time, a quick Google search is going to give you 1,000 instances of a case where someone was diagnosed as brain dead and wasn't.
That, honestly, that's a really good point, and that, like, I think we can see progression in this. Like, before you have Google and instant access to the internet and this, I don't know, was there more of just this immediate reliance on the medical expert, and now there is a kind of pushback?
I don't know. I think it probably varies. I know that there's also some interesting religious views on life and death as it, like, comports with the human body. So, and I'm going based completely off of my grandmother, who was Catholic, and I recognize doesn't completely represent the entire Catholic Church, but I know she was very much in favor of, like, everything possible, all possible means to keep someone alive, even if they are completely dependent on machines, because as long as there's life, there's hope.
Okay.
And, like, prioritizing life above all else. Right. And not ever, basically, you know, if I'm on a machine, don't take me off the machine. But my understanding is that's kind of historically been the Catholic Church's stance of, like, prioritizing any kind of life, because God can work miracles. As long as there's life, then there's a chance. And I think in other denominations, there's different, like, ways of, I don't remember, my mom took a class in parish nursing a while ago, and they did, went through, like, different Christian denominations and views, and I can't remember who it was, but one denomination, the official stance was basically, you don't have to put a person on life support, but once they're on life support, you shouldn't take them off the life support.
Okay.
So if it's a chance of, like, this person's only going to live if we hook them up to machines, you can say, no, they wouldn't want to live on machines. Let's just let them go. But once you put them on the machines, you can't then go, okay, well, enough of this.
That's interesting.
We're going to take them off. And I think this is, reflects the difficulties of reconciling something that's faith-based versus something that's, and I'm not saying that there's no evidence in faith, and I'm not saying that science and faith are incompatible, but I think that science and faith don't always talk to each other very well.
Yeah. And it's also hard because you have an ideal worldview. Like, this is how the world is supposed to operate when everything is going well. And then you have moments of just horrible tragedy that you never really thought or were taught how to prepare for this. And so you have to reconcile, like, I have to do some things now, but that doesn't really fit with how I've always thought my world would be.
Right. And so I think all of these kind of add up to a lot of cultural anxiety related to the idea of organ donation.
Makes sense.
You know, even people like myself, I'm a firm advocate for it. Absolutely. I've always been an organ donor my whole life. Will always be. Firmly encourage other people to be one. But, you know, the more I read about it, the more I'm like, yeah. It's interesting. I read a thing a while back that said that they did a study that showed that people who watched the television show Grey's Anatomy were less likely to be willing to be organ donors based on how organ donation is reflected on that television show.
That's interesting. I was trying to think back to, like, you know, I've seen a lot of Grey's Anatomy. I really don't remember specific things.
And there's the whole thing with, you know, Denny waiting for the heart, and Izzy making him sicker deliberately so that he'll move to the top of the list. And
I forgot about that.
Then he dies anyway, so.
And then there's the whole ghost thing. Yeah. That is just a, thank you, Shonda, that's a wild ride.
Right.
But it this makes sense, though, because, again, like, with all things, you know, I think we've hit on this before, it's not just coming out in the legends, it's coming out in other forms, too. We get it in popular media, we get it in shows and movies, and we're getting this idea that if you go to a strange country, then you're liable to get your wallet stolen or your kidney stolen or your daughter stolen, like, right. You know, taken, the movie. And so, like, we get it there, we get it in the legend, we hear these actual crimes happening, and it all just kind of feeds into one another.
Right. And that's, I think we've skirted around this, but to explicitly state, as much as organ trafficking clearly is a thing going on in this world, the narratives generally frame it as kind of a wealthy to middle class white American being the victim, and that's not who gets victimized
right.
in organ trafficking schemes
right.
generally. Same thing with sex trafficking.
Right.
We'll address that in a later episode, I'm sure.
Yeah.
The other thing related to religious beliefs and organ donation is that historically a lot of religions have had rules about maintaining bodily integrity after death.
Yeah.
You know, there are religions that don't allow for cremation because of this. And so a lot of those religions have had, you know, historically had negotiations with the idea of organ donation. Can you... I know for a long time, Orthodox Judaism did not allow organ donation because you had to maintain bodily integrity because when the Messiah comes, you are going to be resurrected. Yeah. You have to have your entire body. And I know, I don't know where the official religious stance is now. I do know, having talked to people that were observant or Orthodox, that they've said, well, you know, I kind of always feel like the Messiah is probably going to be powerful enough he can fix that.
Yeah.
And so there's interesting personal negotiations as you're dealing with also institutional negotiations with these ideas. And again, lots and lots of cultural anxiety that gets expressed in legend.
Yeah.
Because that's how legends work. Another interesting thing I found out legally, this is totally out of place because I should have had it somewhere else in my notes, but in some countries you can only do donations from fully living, i.e. not brain dead donors. So again, this is only things like kidneys and livers and things that, or you know, parts of liver, things that you can donate. So the idea being, we'll just totally wipe out this idea of any kind of sketchy stuff if we can only do it when the donor says, yes, I am here, I am alive, and I am willing to donate. Again, we've seen in other instances how that can be coerced, yeah. That can be, you know,
it's there's not all foolproof.
Kinds of, there is no foolproof. Anyway, I think that is all I have to say on this one. Do you have any other thoughts?
No, I think, again, what I love about doing this podcast is I learn so much. Like, going into it, I feel really good on the legend stuff and not knowing this other aspect. And it is always jarring to, like, hear these things. But I don't think that it makes me any more fearful.
No.
That this is, you know, gonna happen to me or loved ones. But it does make me, you know, stop and think.
Right.
Like, okay, what's happening here?
Well, and for me, you know, again, as someone who's always been an advocate for organ donation, I kind of look down my nose at people that aren't, like, come on. Like,
yeah.
What are you doing with them? You're going to be dead anyway. No, they're not going to just not save your life because they want your, like, it's helpful for me to look at all of
right.
this and go, okay, this is why people are
exactly,
afraid.
Yeah.
I can still believe what I believe, and yeah. I can still encourage other people to do what I think they should do, but I can do that from a place of understanding, okay, this is why people have very legitimate
yeah.
reason to fear the medical establishment.
Yeah.
So we are now on a lot of social media. You can follow us on Twitter. We are @CrimeLore1. You can like us on Facebook. We are not on Instagram yet. We will get on Instagram.
Yeah.
I'm not a good Instagram user.
I'm not either.
One of our friends jokingly volunteered to run our Instagram, and I may force her to do that because I'm not good at it. But we should be on Instagram.
Yeah.
You can also find our website at crimelorepod.com. And until next time, if you leave a bar with a stranger, keep an eye on your kidneys. Ostension happens.
Crime Lore is written, researched, and produced by Christina Downs. Additional scholarly expertise from Jesse A. Fivecoat. Recording by Jesse Fivecoat and Christina Downs. Cover art by Ben Bridges. For a list of sources cited in each episode, check out our website at crimelorepod.com.